forward to. Jesus Christ and his death on the cross and his resurrection and so forth. But these were written before the time of Christ, in the times of the foreshadowing of Christ. Now, I listed examples of salvation history psalms. They include Psalm 78, 105, 106, 135, and 136. Now, we're going to look closely at 78, but before we do so, I want to address our connection with the salvation history psalms. I don't want you to read Psalm 78 if you are a believer in a totally detached way, totally detached from the people that this is speaking about. Even if we are Gentiles, we are connected with God's people in the Old Testament, provided we share the faith of Abraham. Hold on to the Psalms and turn over to Romans chapter 4, verse 16, to see that even Gentile believers are connected with God's people in the Old Testament. Romans 4, I'll begin reading at verse 16. This chapter is about justification by faith. We're told about Abraham, who was justified by faith. Verse 16, that is why it depends on faith, in order that the promise may rest on grace and be guaranteed to all his offspring, referring to Abraham's offspring. Not only to the adherent of the law, but also to the one who shares the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made you the father of many nations. In the presence of the God in whom he believed, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. So we're told in verse 16 that the promise of a righteousness, this blessing from God, of a right standing with God, this promise is guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring, not just Jewish believers, referred to here as the adherent of the law, but also to Gentile believers, referred to here as also to the one who shares the faith of Abraham without being an adherent of the law. So both the Gentile believer and the Jewish believer are counted as Abraham's offspring. And he is therefore the father of all believers, of all who share the faith of Abraham. We won't turn there, but you can see similar things in Romans 11, which talks about Gentile believers being grafted in. Galatians 3:7, which says that the Abraham's sons are those who are of faith. So the redeemed in the Old Testament, such as Abraham, Sarah, Moses, and David, are our forefathers in a greater sense than our merely natural forefathers. So you see, we are much more like the redeemed of any age than our merely natural forefathers. Just think about that for a moment. Say you have a grandfather who is not a believer in Jesus Christ. Now, you may share some physical similarity with your unbelieving grandfather. You may share some of the same environment with your unbelieving grandfather. But your unbelieving grandfather is a part of the world. As a believer, you have been set apart from the world unto God. And therefore, you have a lot more in common with people like Abraham, Sarah, Moses, and David, who were called by God to be part of his people, who are believers in God. You have a lot more in common with them than with any physical forefather who is not in Christ. And that's the idea in Romans 4. We share the faith of Abraham, and we are like him, and we are included in the promise that was given to him for his offspring, because we are in Christ, who is his ultimate offspring. So, the history of God's people in the Old Testament is, in a sense, our history, and should be read as our history. Old Testament history is more our history than the history you will read in a secular textbook of the United States of America. We have a lot more in common with our spiritual forefathers than with our physical forefathers. Because of this, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1, Paul says to a believing Gentile audience in Corinth, "For I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea." He refers to the Israelites in the wilderness who are in the old covenant. He refers to them as our fathers. Even though these are Gentile believers that Paul is speaking to, he says, not my fathers, but our fathers were in the wilderness. So with that in mind, seeing our connection with the people in the old covenant, let us read Psalm 78. The inscription says, "A Maskil of Asaph." That means Asaph wrote this psalm. "Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known, that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and His might and the wonders that He has done. He established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers to teach to their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise and tell them to their children, so they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments, and that they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God." Just stop right there. Here we are introduced to the salvation history by being told that we're going to reflect on these great deeds that the Lord has done. The glorious deeds of the Lord and His might, the wonders that He has done. And the reason we are going to look back on these acts of God throughout salvation history, and the reason why we are going to teach them to our children with the hope that they will teach them to their children, is so that we will set our hope in God. That's the purpose of looking at history here. The history of God's dealings with His people. We look back at it so that we will set our hope in God. Verse 7, "and not forget the works, but keep His commandments, and that we should not be like our forefathers, who were a stubborn and rebellious generation." So, in the salvation history, we come across many negative examples of people who were in the Old Covenant who did not believe. And we are given these examples so that we will not be like them. They did not have a proper relationship to the great deeds that God performed. We're being warned by their example to respond properly to these great deeds that God has done in history. He goes on in verse 9. "The Ephraimites, armed with the bow..." Ephraimites is another name for Israelites, being that Ephraim was one of the largest tribes in Israel. Can stand for the whole nation. "The Ephraimites, armed with the bow, turned back on the day of battle. They did not keep God's covenant, but refused to walk according to His law. They forgot His works and the wonders that He had shown them." Now, we're not told which specific event is in mind here. I wonder if when it says that they were armed with the bow but turned back on the day of battle, I do wonder if the author has in mind when the Israelites were brought the first time to the land of Canaan and they refused to enter and take possession of it, but we're not told that specifically. But what we have here is the Israelites are instructed by God to engage in battle against some of the inhabitants of the promised land, and they refused to do so. They turned their back on the day of battle. They did not keep God's covenant. They refused to walk according to His law. Now, here's the heart of the problem. They, in verse 11, they forgot His works and the wonders that He had shown them. That's why they didn't follow the Lord, because they forgot the great works that God had done for them. They forgot His works and the wonders that He had shown them. In the sight of their fathers, He performed wonders in the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan. Zoan was a city near where the Israelites were living in the land of Egypt before God delivered them. Verse 12, in the sight of their fathers, He performed wonders in the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan. He divided the sea and let them pass through it, and made the waters stand like a heap. In the daytime, He led them with a cloud, and all the night with a fiery light. He split rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep. He made streams come out of the rock and caused waters to flow down like rivers. So God works in a very special, miraculous, gracious way for His people. He didn't do things like this for the previous generation or the generation before that. But this generation, the Lord delivered through the miracle of dividing the Red Sea, miraculously provided for them again and again in the wilderness. Now you would expect them to keep this in mind. They have never seen anything like this. Their fathers have never seen anything like this. You would expect them to remember this. You would expect their life to be changed forever. Verse 17, yet they sinned still more against Him, rebelling against the Most High in the desert. They tested God in their heart by demanding the food they craved. You see here what was all important to them, what they worshipped. They worshipped their stomachs. They worshipped that food that they didn't have. They craved these things. Verse 19, they spoke against God, saying, can God spread a table in the wilderness? He struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams overflowed. Can He also give bread or provide meat for His people? Therefore, when the Lord heard, He was full of wrath. A fire was kindled against Jacob. His anger rose against Israel because they did not believe in God and did not trust His saving power. There's the heart of it. It's coupled together with that forgetting. They forget the great deeds of the Lord. They do not believe in God. They do not trust in His saving power. Verse 23. Yet He commanded the skies above and opened the doors of heaven, and He rained down on them manna to eat and gave them the grain of heaven. Man ate of the bread of the angels. He sent them food in abundance. He caused the east wind to blow in the heavens, and by His power He let out the south wind. He rained meat on them like dust, winged birds like the sand of the seas. He let them fall in the midst of their camp, all around their dwellings. And they ate and were filled, for He gave them what they craved. But before they had satisfied their craving, while the food was still in their mouths, the anger of God rose against them, and He killed the strongest of them and laid low the young men of Israel. He showed that He was more than able to provide meat, if that was what He deemed they needed. But He severely punished them, because they cared far more about meat than they cared about their God. He was jealous of their worship. Verse 31. In spite of all this, they still sinned. Despite His wonders, they did not believe. So He made their days vanish like a breath and their years in terror. When He killed them, they sought Him. They repented and sought God earnestly. You see, God repeatedly wiped out large numbers of the Israelites in punishment for their sins, so that the rest of the community would learn to fear God and to obey Him. It says, verse 34, when He killed them, they sought Him. They repented and sought God earnestly. They remembered that God was their rock, the Most High God, their Redeemer, but they flattered Him with their mouths. they lied to him with their tongues. So with their mouth they repented. With their mouth they turned back to God to worship him. But it was flattery. There was no change of mind. No change of heart. Verse 37, their heart was not steadfast toward him. They were not faithful to his covenant. Yet he being compassionate, that's what we see again and again, is the compassion, the grace, the mercy of God. Yet he being compassionate atoned for their iniquity and did not destroy them. Again and again, he provided atonement for them, a way of atonement, so they could be forgiven when there was a substitutionary blood sacrifice. This was of his grace that he provided such atonement and did not destroy them. The end of verse 38, he restrained his anger often and did not stir up all his wrath. He remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes and comes not again. So he was mindful of their weakness. And so he moved towards them in compassion. Verse 40, how often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. They tested God again and again and provoked the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power or the day when he redeemed them from the foe, when he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the fields of Zoan. He turned their rivers to blood so that they could not drink of their streams. This is referring to the plagues upon Egypt by which he delivered his people. He turned their rivers to blood so that they could not drink of their streams. He sent among them swarms of flies which devoured them and frogs which destroyed them. He gave their crops to the destroying locusts and the fruit of their labor to the locusts. Remember how many of these plagues the Lord made a distinction between Egypt and his chosen people. While the Egyptians suffered the plagues, for the most part the Israelites did not suffer these plagues. Verse 46, he gave their crops to the destroying locusts and the fruit of their labor to the locusts. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamores with frost. He gave over their cattle to the hail and their flocks to thunderbolts. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death, but gave their lives over to the plague. He struck down every firstborn in Egypt, the firstfruits of their strength in the tents of Ham. Then he led out his people like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. Reminds us of what Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. All the way back in the wilderness, God was shepherding his people. Verse 53, he led them in safety so that they were not afraid, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And he brought them to his holy land, to the mountain which his right hand had won. I would guess that this mountain being referred to here is Mount Sinai, where God dwelled and revealed his covenant to his people. Verse 55, he drove out nations before them. He apportioned them for a possession and settled the tribes of Israel in their tents. Yet they tested and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies. So even after his miraculous provision for them in the wilderness, even after all the judgments against those who very clearly and publicly rebelled against God, after God gave them the land of promise that the previous generation refused to take out of fear, God gave it to them. After all that, still we see in verse 56, them testing and rebelling against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned away and acted treacherously like their fathers. They twisted like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places. They moved him to jealousy with their idols. When God heard, he was full of wrath. They lived just like those pagan Canaanites that God had set them apart from and told them not to be like. God had warned them, yet they still built the same idolatrous high places to worship the false gods. They built the same idols, they bowed down to the same idols of the Canaanites, moving God to jealousy. He is jealous for the worship that is his due. Verse 59, when God heard, he was full of wrath and he utterly rejected Israel. He forsook his dwelling at Shiloh. Shiloh was one of the locations where the tabernacle was. He forsook his dwelling at Shiloh, the tent where he dwelt among mankind, and delivered his power to captivity, his glory to the hand of the foe. Here, God's power and glory refers to the Ark of the Covenant that God delivered to captivity when the Philistines captured it. Delivered His glory to the hand of the foe. God didn't see this as some accident that happened without Him noticing. No, He was in full control of this. He delivered that precious piece of furniture, that throne of God on which, above which God dwelled, He delivered that over to the Philistines as a punishment upon Israel. Verse 62, He gave His people over to the sword and vented His wrath on His heritage. Fire devoured their young men and their young women had no marriage song. This is referring to those judgments that came from God after they were in the land. If you go through those cycles in the book of Judges, where God sends enemies against them, then delivers them, then sends them again because the people are unchanged, still in their sin. That continues on again and again. Verse 63, fire devoured their young men and their young women had no marriage song. Their priests fell by the sword and their widows made no lamentation. Then the Lord awoke as from sleep, like a strong man shouting because of wine. And He put His adversaries to rout. He put them to everlasting shame. He rejected the tent of Joseph and did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but He chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which He loves. He built His sanctuary like the high heavens, like the earth which He has founded forever. Referring to how the tabernacle was moved to Mount Zion, where David planned to have built later on the great temple. Verse 70. He chose David His servant and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the nursing ewes. He brought him to shepherd Jacob His people, Israel His inheritance. We saw earlier that the Lord shepherded His people in the wilderness. Now He gives them a mediator who will shepherd them on His behalf. From following the nursing ewes, He brought him to shepherd Jacob His people, Israel His inheritance. With upright heart He shepherded them and guided them with His skillful hand. This is the note that this salvation history psalm ends on. It ends on a note of hope. We have seen such blackness with the overwhelming unbelief and rebellion of the majority of those in the Old Covenant. Yet, there is hope at the end of this telling of God's dealings with His people. God places on the throne this figure, David, who of course is a foreshadow of Jesus Christ, who will reign in perfect righteousness, in perfect grace, bringing the salvation to His people. We see here the nature of God's mankind. This is what we tend towards, this rebellion, this unbelief. It takes an act of grace and mercy on God's behalf to change a heart from this into a heart like the heart that God gave to David and Moses and Abraham and you and I who are in Jesus Christ today. I like how the ESV Study Bible summarizes Psalm 78. This is how it summarizes it. The story is one of constant disbelief in the face of unimaginable grace. What kind of a God is there who again and again and again shows mercy to a people that largely continues in rebellion? No man, no God that man would ever create in mythology would ever be like this. Only the true God is like this. The story is one of constant disbelief in the face of unimaginable grace, and even more grace being granted in the face of disbelief. What's highlighted here is nothing in man. What's highlighted in here is the grace and the mercy, the forbearance, the patience, the love of God. Now, The fact that there are several psalms like this in the Psalter, psalms that go over the history of God's working salvifically amongst his people, the fact that we have such psalms tells us that history is important. And we see the same thing echoed in the New Testament, an indication of the importance of history. Look at Hebrews chapter 12. I'm going to start reading at verse 1. Hebrews 12:1. Now this comes after chapter 11, which tells us about the faith of Abel, the faith of Enoch, of Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, the Israelites of the Red Sea, Rahab, and then the prophets and so forth. After telling us about these forefathers who are examples of faith, we read in chapter 12, verse 1, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." He says, we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. This is referring to the people in chapter 11 who trusted in God. They are the great cloud of witnesses. Since we are surrounded by these other saints who have trusted in God, often with great cost, with great suffering involved, because they were following God in faith. Because we are surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses, let us also, like them, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. These saints who have gone before us are examples of faith. Their faith was in God. They looked to God. And we are encouraged by their example to also look to God. Now, after the cross, to look specifically to Jesus. Every one of them who's gone before us is pointing us to God. We're to be encouraged by them to look to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. We're to be mindful of our history. And seeing the examples of faith, we are then to look to the same place that they looked. Our eyes are not to stay on Moses, not to stay on Abraham, not to stay on Sarah, but to move to the one they look to, ultimately to Christ. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility, that we may not grow weary or faint-hearted. Kind of the reverse of Psalm 78. Both of them looking back at history. Psalm 78 primarily looking at negative examples. Hebrews looking at positive examples. But both of them saying history is important. And that continues on after the completion of the Bible. The other saints who have lived between the time of the end of the New Testament and today, they are also added to this great cloud of witnesses spoken of in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Even though they are not mentioned in Scripture, they are still examples for us of faith, and they too should be an encouragement to us to look to Jesus. So there is value in Christian biography. While Christian biography should never take the place of the Bible itself, there is great value in reading about the lives of saints who have gone before us throughout the ages, who have looked to Jesus, the author and perfecter of their faith. Now, coming back to Psalm 78, what were we told was the purpose of going through this history at the very beginning? So that we will not forget these great acts of God. And that remembering the great acts of God, we will obey the Lord. We will keep His covenant. So several things go together. Forgetting the great things of God goes together with disobedience and unbelief. Remembering the great acts of God on our behalf goes together with faith and obedience. They're all packages. They come together.